you know, sexual intercourse is forbidden while fasting.
Mm-hmm.
And because not only the fast becomes void, but they should also pay the penalty or the kafara, which is to fast for 60 days, 31 days in a row, or feed 60 people to their fill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you very much, Sheikh Javed. And thank you for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Please keep us in your prayers and supplications.
Fires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Scuffles and unrest were reported in several spots across Sweden. Fierce clashes have broken out between police and protesters during demonstrations against a far-right group's intention to burn the Holy Quran. Violent skirmishes erupted between supporters of the Strom Kurs party and the opponents of the blasphemous plan. Clashes and demonstrations have been held in a couple of cities. Over a dozen police officers have also been injured since the unrest started. Meanwhile, police has backed the hardline party's plan, saying it would not revoke permission for a demonstration organized by the party, because this free speech threshold for doing that is very high in Sweden. That's why there have been reported clashes in locations that the hardline party either had planned or had demonstrations. Also, Swedish Prime Minister Magdalena Andersson came out in support of the far-right group, making remarks that have been deemed provocative. She said in Sweden, people are allowed to express their opinions whether they are in good or bad taste. That is part of our democracy. These remarks only fanned the fire of unrest across the country and drew condemnations from the Muslim world, like from Iran. Iran summoned the Swedish envoy and condemned the desecration of the Holy Quran, saying the blasphemy was committed under the protection of the Swedish police. Tehran said it would hold the Swedish government as accountable and expects an immediate reaction from Stockholm against the perpetrator, as well as practical measures to prevent such incidents. On Thursday, the hardline party held a rally in a heavily Muslim-populated area in Sweden. At the demonstration, the party leader burned a copy of the Holy Quran, ignoring objections from onlookers. Counter-protests broke out with demonstrators setting fire to security vehicles after police ignored calls to stop the far-right demonstration. Strom Kurs is well known for its anti-immigrant and anti-Islam stances. Anti-Muslim sentiments have been on the rise across Europe in recent years in the wake of terrorist attacks in the continent, carried out mostly by Daesh sympathizers or the terrorist group's members who returned home following the group's defeat in Iraq and Syria. Muslim leaders in Europe and around the world have repeatedly condemned the terrorist attacks. Moreover, the rise of far-right ideology and the propagation of anti-immigration policies have also exacerbated the status of religious minorities in Europe. Also, different sorts of bans on hijab in countries like Germany and France, as well as closure of mosques and religious centers, have further pressured the Muslim community in those countries. Add to it the discrimination in recruitment and provision of job opportunities, harassment at workplace, and hate speech. Also, hate crimes against Muslims are rife in Europe. While the Muslim communities represent an indispensable minority of more than 25 million people, In the 27 European Union member states, a 2018 poll found that within the bloc, an average 37% of the population admits to having unfavorable views of Muslims. The mainstream Western media usually give coverage to Muslim matters through the prism of negative and counterproductive stereotypes. This biased coverage further promotes unreal stereotypes. In addition, European leaders have either been unsuccessful or reluctant in providing a convincing counter-narrative to Islamophobia. The UK has announced a controversial deal with Rwanda to send illegal immigrants and asylum seekers to the East African country. The British government claims this scheme, which is worth $156 million, would stop smugglers from sending thousands of desperate migrants on dangerous journeys across the English Channel every year. Over 28,000 migrants and refugees have crossed the English Channel in 2021. That's three times higher than the year before. In November last year, 27 people died while trying to reach the UK when their boat sank in the worst disaster to occur on the Channel. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson hailed the deal with Kigali, saying the East African country with a sketchy human rights record is one of the safest countries in the world, globally recognized for its record of welcoming and integrating migrants. Rwanda already hosts some 140,000 refugees in six refugee camps. However, rights groups and refugee organizations swiftly slammed what they called a cruel, inhumane, and neo-colonial plan. They also questioned both its costs to British taxpayers and its effect on migration. According to a recent poll, 60% of the British public is dissatisfied with the Johnson government's migration policy. The UN's refugee agency has also voiced opposition, saying people fleeing persecution should not be treated like commodities. The world body stated that such arrangements simply shift asylum responsibilities, evade international obligations, and are contrary to the letter and spirit of the Refugee Convention. Others have criticized Rwanda's human rights record, accusing the government of torturing, intimidating, and assassinating their political opponents and persecuting marginalized people. Johnson said the deal will become a new international standard in handling migration, but human rights groups have warned that the plan could set a dangerous trend for other Western countries to adopt their offshore asylum schemes.
Well, Britain has a good history of trading in human beings. As you know, the whole sort of movement of Africans to North America, Britain was a leading player in shipping slaves from Africa to North America and to Caribbean islands. So Britain has a track record of trading in human beings. So one could, if you like, describe it in that manner. But I think the evil aspect of what's really happening in 2022, that may have happened 200 years ago, and when later on slavery was banned. But the reality is that perhaps we are living in a new epoch of slavery at this time.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has vowed to curb the English Channel crossings. However, there has been a drastic increase in the number of people arriving on British shores on small boats in recent years. The government passed a Nationality and Borders Bill that would make it a criminal offence to enter the UK illegally, and it would introduce life sentences for people smugglers. But the UN's refugee agency criticized the bill, saying it would penalize most refugees seeking asylum in the country and would create an asylum model that undermines established international refugee protection rules and practices. Meanwhile, the refugee deal with Rwanda comes as more Ukrainians arrive in the UK through different visa programs that the Johnson government has rolled out in the wake of the Russia-Ukraine war. Over 55,000 visas have been issued to refugees fleeing the conflict in Ukraine so far. This clearly shows a contradiction between the proposed policy and the British government's attitude toward Ukrainian refugees.
The reality is that the British government is acting in a very racist manner as well. You know, they might say that, okay, it was sort of media correspondents who depicted the European the Ukrainian refugees in that manner. But the reality is that the implementation of this policy perhaps smacks of what I call racism, clear and without any sort of dilution to it.
Unlike what the British government claims, those seeking to cross the English Channel and land on British soil are not illegal economic migrants, but are mainly those who have escaped bloodshed, war and terror. They are people fleeing oppression and violence from Afghanistan, West Asia or even Europe. They are exercising their right under the UN Refugee Convention, which the UK was a founding signatory of, to seek asylum in a country of their choosing. And let's not forget that they are no different from Ukrainian refugees.
Israeli forces have stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied old city of Al-Quds and attacked the Palestinian worshippers there. The raid began at dawn on Friday when Israeli forces entered the compound through the Moroccan Gate, also known as the Mughrabi Gate, throwing stun grenades and shooting rubber bullets at the crowd indiscriminately. 400 Palestinians were arrested. Media reports said the Israeli forces also attacked paramedics and press crews, chased them in the courtyards of Al-Aqsa Mosque, and beat a number of them. The Palestinian Red Crescent Society reported that 152 fasting Palestinians had been transferred to hospitals in the occupied Al-Quds for injuries as a result of the raid. Following the Friday prayers, people held rallies in the Gaza Strip in solidarity with the Palestinians at the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
They want it for themselves. They want the Palestinians gone. They want Islam to be gone from Palestine and Christianity too, everything except Judaism. So really, they don't mind having this as a flashpoint for them, as a center of dispute. They want this dispute to go on until they win. That's what they're looking for. And every time they bring settlers there to cause trouble, it's part of what they see as a continuing war for their control of the land. That's what this is about.
The regime has stepped up its deadly acts of aggression across the Palestinian territories since the beginning of Ramadan, as a result of which, Palestinians put up a stronger resistance to counter the aggression. The events unfolding in the occupied territories are reminiscent of clashes between the Israeli forces and Palestinians in the West Bank last year that led to an 11-day war between the resistance groups in Gaza and Israel. Over 250 Palestinians were killed in the war, many of them were women and children. Observers now believe that more confrontations are imminent. As the pressure mounts, Palestinians have stepped up their retaliatory operations against Israelis. Over the past 3 weeks, Palestinians have carried out 4 such retaliatory operations, killing over a dozen Israelis. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett has given the regime's forces a free hand to crack down on Palestinians. He has also called on Israeli civilians with gun licenses to carry weapons in public.
They can find ways to make the Israeli occupation painful, and already actually quite a few Israelis over the last decade have emigrated elsewhere. You have Israeli immigration into Europe and the United States and to Australia. Possibly as many as 1 million Israelis have done that. If the Palestinians can make it painful enough for the Israelis might just disappear.
When some Arab states announced the normalization of ties with Israel, they claimed that their moves will help the Palestinian cause. But the events of the past couple of years have shown that the only contribution their newly established ties with Tel Aviv made to Palestinians has been even more suffering. In the absence of any accountability, Israel is expected to put even more pressure on the people of Palestine. But the Palestinians are indicating that they remain steadfast to keep fighting against the Israeli occupation with or without international support.
Racial tensions are running high in Grand Rapids, Michigan, after police this week released footage of a white officer lying on the back of an unarmed black man, shooting him in the head. Patrick Leoya, 26, was killed on April 4th after a struggle during a traffic stop. State police are investigating the incident. The officer is currently on administrative leave pending the outcome of the investigation. Authorities say he would not be identified unless criminal charges are pressed against him. The family of Leoya called the video of the shooting, quote, the most horrifying thing they've ever seen, and asked for the officer's name to be released. The shooting has led to protests in the area, with activists expressing grief and frustration with years of inaction on policing issues by Grand Rapids leaders.
Given the U.S.'s long history of police brutality, from Rodney King to George Floyd and now today, we can't be shocked. And I think that the black community should and is justified in being angry at the establishment and seeking methods outside of the establishment and the political structure for seeking change.
The fatal shooting of the unarmed black man by the white officer is the latest on a very long list of similar incidents. Police killings of black men have dominated national debates in recent years, particularly after the 2020 murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis, which triggered persistent protests across America. The deep-rooted problem lingers on. So far this year, over 250 people have been fatally shot by on-duty police officers nationwide. The latest case is another bitter reminder that the system in the United States has failed to take measures to resolve the pressing problem. The April 4th shooting has once again brought deadly police violence in America under the spotlight. Civil rights organization, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, has been quick to react. The NAACP, which tries to advance justice for African Americans, said in a statement that the shooting is horrifying and deeply frustrating because Americans had meaningful legislation designed to avoid exactly what they are witnessing in this week's police video. It said the involved officer has blood on his hands, and so do the senators who killed the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act. The piece of legislation was passed by the U.S. House of Representatives in March 2021, but bipartisan negotiations in the U.S. Congress over the police reform bill ended in stalemate. The sweeping legislation was passed by the House amid outcry after the murder of George Floyd. It would have banned chokeholds and qualified immunity for law enforcement. It would have also created national standards for policing in an effort to increase accountability.
Lack of efforts to reform the system that are coming from the top. There's no real incentive for legislators to reform when they are benefiting off of the corrupt policing system and corrupt judicial system that this country has. There's also a lack of struggle in the organizations, a lack of structure in the organizations that are struggling against police brutality.
The failure to pass the police reform has been considered as a setback for the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden, who had energetically supported the legislation. President Biden has faced growing calls to sign an executive order to reform the police, but has failed to act. Experts believe ethnic minorities in America, especially African Americans, are facing a very deep-rooted problem that will not be resolved anytime soon. Observers have largely attributed this to the racist roots of American policing and social structures.
In this night of destiny, which is better than a thousand months, dear Lord, we beseech you to shape our destiny in the most excellent manner.
ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره، همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being. A brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام إذا أضرت النوافل بالفرائض فارفضوها.
Imam Ali said, when optional issues, the nawafil, stand in the way of the wajib, the fara'id, then abandon the nawafil. Thank you. Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio. The program's to my brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali, alayhi salam. Dear friends, when we're discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali, alayhi salam, of course, we find that this divinely appointed Imam is a spring of knowledge and wisdom. It seems that this divine knowledge and this divine wisdom flows from the depths of the soul of Imam Ali alayhi salam. And it is really not that strange for this to occur for individuals such as Imam Ali alayhi salam. They are connected to the divine. They are connected with the Almighty Allah. One of the things in this holy month of Ramadan that we endeavor and undertake is to establish and strengthen and increase our connection with the Almighty Allah. Fasting in these days of the holy month of Ramadan really teaches us so many things. One of those things, dear friends, is generosity. Imam Ali alayhi salam says, generosity has its roots in man's dignity. Hence, to hold others under obligation against one's generosity is contrary to a human being's greatness. Generosity is one of the things which we practice and we learn in the holy month of Ramadan. And generosity comes from one's dignity, one's honor, one's nobility. It is a human being's honor and nobility and dignity, the respect and love for others that brings about generosity. You give something for the sake of Allah. You are generous for the sake of Allah. But then Imam Ali alayhi salam says, there is something which is contrary to a human being's greatness. What is that? That is when one holds others under obligation for their generosity. Meaning, I gave something for the sake of Allah. I gave some charity, or I gave away a gift to a fellow human being for the sake of Allah, in the name of Allah. And then later on, I say, do you remember I gave you such and such thing? Do you remember I gave you charity? Do you remember I did this and this for you? Allahu Akbar. Imam Ali says, this is contrary to human beings' greatness. If you are generous, and if you give in the way of Allah, as the tradition says, give in a manner where your one hand does not know that the other hand has given away charity. A beautiful and profound lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم إني أسألك الأمان يوم لا ينفع مال ولا بنون إلا من أتى الله بقلب سليم.
O Allah, I ask you for the protection of the day when property will not avail, nor sons except he who comes with a heart free from evil.
وأسألك الأمان يوم يعض الظالم على يدي يقول يا ليتني اتخذت مع الرسول
And I ask you for protection on the day when the unjust one will bite his hands, saying, "Oh, would that I had taken away with the messenger."
ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non-muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib. This means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
We invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
Ali is the need of our time, the 20th century. We need him now. Look at even the United Nations when they issued this famous report about the socio-economic, you know, situation in the Arab world, about the development there. They actually emphasized to the Arabs that we are not asking you to follow the West. Go back to your own sources and your own books. And then they have a quotation, a passage from Nahjul Balagha, the letter that Ali wrote to Malik Ashtar. They said, look at that. He's from your world. And follow that. And so my message to us, especially this year, is that how much do we know about Ali? How much do you know about the sayings of Ali and the lectures which are there, the sermons which are there in Nahjul Balagha? You know, Shaheed Murtaza Mutahiri has a very good statement in his brief commentary on Nahjul Balagha where he says, we are like the salesman of the perfume who goes around, you know, sells the perfume, gives them, this is the, you know, sample version of it, use on yourself. Spreads the fragrance around. But if you look at himself, there is no smell there. We go around and talk about Ali. But have we taken that ilm and wisdom and knowledge of Ali, rubbed it on ourselves or not? We don't need, you know, non-Muslims to appreciate Ali and write about Ali, study his ideas and thoughts and then present to us. And then we say, mashallah, you know, Christians are saying this about Ali. What about us? Let us make a commitment with Ali ibn Abi Talib tonight. That at least from now on, we'll pick up Nahjul Balagha. And if you don't want to buy, don't worry about it. Online version is free. Go to the last segment of Nahjul Balagha, the sayings. Short sayings there. Make a point of reading and studying and pondering on one saying per week. And this is where you will come to realize who is Ali. And you will get closer to him and his ideas and his expectation that he has from his followers, especially from his Shia.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
In the limelight.
Needless to say, the U.S. government has killed many people in its military interventions abroad, most recently in West Asia and Africa. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Lori Calhoun, writer. This article is published under the heading America's Exceptional Amnesia. Here's the story. Needless to say, the U.S. government has killed many people in its military interventions abroad, most recently in West Asia and Africa. Yet Americans are often hesitant to apply the label war criminal even to figures such as George W. Bush and Donald Rumsfeld, whose global so-called war on terror has sowed massive destruction, death, and misery, adversely affecting millions of persons for more than 20 years. Nor do people generally regard affable Barack Obama as a war criminal, despite the considerable harm to civilians unleashed by his ill-advised war on Libya. Drone warrior Obama also undertook a concerted campaign to kill rather than capture terrorist suspects in countries such as Pakistan, with which the United States was not at war, and he armed radical rebel forces in Syria, which exacerbated the conflict already underway, resulting in the death of even more civilians. Obama's material and logistical support for the Saudi war against Yemen gave rise to a full-fledged humanitarian crisis, with disease and starvation ravaging the population. Moving a bit farther back in time, U.S. citizens and their sympathizers abroad typically do not affix the label war criminal to Bill Clinton either, despite the fact that his 1999 bombing of Kosovo appears to have been motivated in part to distract attention from his domestic scandal at the time. The moment Clinton began dropping bombs on Kosovo, the press, in a show of patriotic solidarity, abruptly switched its attention from the notorious blue dress to the war in progress. Throughout his presidency, Clinton not only bombed, but also imposed severe sanctions on Iraq, as a result of which hundreds of thousands of civilians died of preventable diseases. Despite knowing about at least some of the atrocities committed in their name by the U.S. government, including torture, summary execution, maiming, the provision of weapons to murderers, sanctions, preventing access to medication and food, etc., many Americans have no difficulty identifying other world leaders as a war criminal, while simultaneously withholding that label from their own leaders. Viewed from a broader historical perspective, none of this may seem new. During wartime, much of the populace dutifully parrots pundits and politicians in denouncing the foreign leaders with whom they disagree as criminals, while supporting the military initiatives of their own leaders, no matter what they do. In the use of the term of derogation war criminal, then, no more than a reflection of the tribe to which one subscribes. All wars result in avoidable harms to innocent, non-threatening people, death and maiming, the destruction of property, impoverishment, psychological trauma, and diminished quality of life for those lucky enough to survive. Given these harsh realities, some critics maintain that all war is immoral. But morality and legality are not one and the same, for crimes violate written laws. We know that the U.S. 2003 invasion of Iraq was illegal according to the letter of the law, not only because former U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan plainly stated that it was, but also because the U.S. government drafted a war resolution only to withdraw it when it emerged that they did not have enough support to secure the needed U.N. approval. If U.S. leaders had believed that the invasion was completely legitimate according to the terms of the U.N. Charter, then they would have felt no need to draft a resolution in justifying it. Ex post facto, when it emerged that the alleged WMD serving as one of the primary pretexts for the war were nowhere to be found, the U.S. government claimed that the 2003 invasion of Iraq was simply a continuation of the 1991 Persian Gulf War, which had received the support of the United Nations, or was justified because Saddam Hussein allegedly tried to assassinate George H.W. Bush in 1993, or because previous UN resolutions relating to the disarmament of Iraq and the elimination of its biological and chemical warfare capacity implied that military force would be permissible in the event of Saddam Hussein's non-compliance. On the propaganda front, the U.S. administration also pumped through the media pretexts, such as that the people of Iraq needed to be liberated from their ruthless dictator, and it was high time to allow democracy to flourish throughout the land. People have been writing about war crimes for millennia, long before the establishment of the United Nations and the ICC, International Criminal Court. The framework proffered in 1945 UN Charter derives from the classical just war tradition. By definition, a war criminal is someone who commits war crimes. But according to just war theory, there are two ways to become an unjust warrior. One is to wage an unjust war. The other is to conduct a war unjustly. These two forms of injustice are outlined in the Jus ad bellum and Jus in bello, requirements on a just war, the interpretive fluidity of which has often been seized upon by political leaders intent on waging war. Such leaders use just war theory opportunistically as a template in developing pro-war propaganda. The aim of the drafters of the UN Charter was to rein in such bellicose tendencies and thereby avert tragic and massively destructive conflicts such as the First and Second World Wars by requiring explicit and intersubjective agreement among nations before a war could be waged. Deception is a form of coercion, which implies that a leader who offers false pretext to secure the approval of the UN Security Council, as did George H.W. Bush in 1991, is no less a criminal than a leader whose war abjectly violates the written letter of the law, as in the case of his son, George W. Bush's 2003 invasion of Iraq. Indeed, in predicting how leaders will conduct themselves during the prosecution of war, there may be no dependable indicator than how they went about garnering support for it. By now, it is common knowledge that all of the proffered pretexts for the 2003 invasion of Iraq were bogus, from the non-existent WMDs to the alleged collaboration between Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden. Given the many lies used to persuade politicians and pundits to support the invasion, no one should have been surprised when those who waged a criminal war proceeded to render and torture suspects, kill civilians at checkpoints, deploy white phosphorus and depleted uranium-tipped missiles, raise entire cities, and terrorize civilians with lethal drones. Biden's debilitated mental state and inability to keep his story straight is the perfect metaphor for the attitude of Americans toward war criminals. They blithely ignore or brush aside the crimes committed by their own leaders, while supporting policies which will intensify rather than resolve conflicts abroad.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson: what is a jurisprudential fasting? Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. Religious fasting may be observed in three different levels. Number one is fasting of al-Sharia, which is the jurisprudential fasting. Fasting for many Muslims is mainly to refrain from what they must jurisprudentially refrain from, such as eating, drinking, sexual intercourse, etc. Although this is the lowest and the least level of religious fasting, once it is offered for the sake of Allah, the faster is religiously considered fasting. To give you an idea of how long the level or how low the level of this stage is, let me share some examples with you. A Muslim girl may fast without practicing her Islamic dress code at school. And her fasting is valid on this level. Because like we said, it's the lowest level. There are do's and don'ts of this lowest level. So if she's not wearing hijab, but she is performing all those other do's and don'ts, which are necessary for fasting, then she is considered to be fasting. A Muslim may observe fasting and yet listen to rock and roll, and his or her fasting is jurisprudentially valid. Again, keep in mind that we're discussing the lowest level of fasting. There's so many other vices that a faster may be performing while he or she is fasting, but their fast would be valid at this lowest level. And this is the jurisprudential fasting. And we're going to discuss this more after the break. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing the jurisprudential fasting, which is considered to be the lowest level of fasting for any Muslim. No doubt, the purpose of fasting is not just to avoid food and drink, and hence, this is the very lowest level of fasting for the very beginners to start their journey towards perfection and promotion. Keep in mind that this is not the end. This is the beginning. Thus, it is quoted from the Holy Prophet, Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, that many people gain nothing from their fasting save hunger and thirst. Notice how he still qualifies it to be a fast, but he's saying that you don't gain anything more than what you are getting, and that is just hunger and thirst. The Sharia fasting, or the jurisprudential fasting, is prescribed for beginners as a form of training to help them become acquainted to waking up at dawn with the excuse of eating and drinking, lest they feel hungry and thirsty during the day, in order for them to experience the pleasant breeze at dawn, to be awake at a time when the divine cups of spirituality are served. The least he is expected, therefore, to gain by the end of this blessed month of Ramadan is to have gotten used to offering his or her morning prayers on time. This is the least of the expectations. Unfortunately, many people, they're fasting from their childhood. But, you know, they grow older and older and older, but never think about moving beyond this jurisprudential fasting level, this basic level, right? This is a very unfortunate thing. And inshallah, may we not be from amongst those people whose previous year fasts were no different than this year fast. This year, we have to move to the next level. We have to exert ourselves and make sure that we are taking one step further, to say the least. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
There is endless lamenting and an anxiety these days about plastic pollution and how to control it. You would think it was a new problem, but of course, along with all forms of pollution, the plastic waste challenge has been with us for a long time. But it was in the 70s that the environmentalist entrepreneur Doe Rossi noticed a business opportunity out of this situation and made a pledge to do something about it for future generations. What did he do? He created the so-called Pollywood by using recycled plastic and wood. Hello everyone and welcome to another edition of Bozor. In this show, we will look at the wood plastic composite sector and its developing markets in Iran. Nowadays, products of this relatively new sector are all around us and rapidly expanding into new varieties and applications. In this program, we will discover how the never-ending expansion of Pollywood world is facilitating a shift towards a more sustainable environment and explore its role in economic growth. As a response to sustainability trends and the need to preserve forests and prevent the destruction of the precious resources, we are witnessing the growing expansion of the plastic wood industry in the world. Accordingly, Pollywood has been in Iranian markets for a couple of decades now. One of the leading manufacturers of this green product is a company that uses Decowood as its brand name in Iran. With significant investment and up-to-date technical knowledge, this company has been able to produce different types of plastic wood profiles in various applications by making about 40 types of molds, which gives designers and architects more freedom in their designs. Wood polymer composites are a relatively new product. The current market of 220,000 tons per year has been developed over about 20 years of intense activity. In fact, according to some experts, the product can trace its roots to much earlier with GOR producing woodstock for Fiat cars in 1972 and subsequently Sonesson AB producing PVC wood fiber floor tiles in Sweden in 1973. Since then, various research activities took place over the decades before the sector gained momentum in the 1990s, seeing four times growth between 1997 and 2000. The new momentum was provided by the dual purpose of replacing petrochemical materials with bio-derived sustainable materials and the need to reduce waste disposal by utilizing new recycling technologies. In this process, WPC was selected as a product into which waste paper or post-consumer plastics, such as used milk jugs, could be recycled. According to a consumer attitude research, the most common reason for the acceptance of wood plastic composites by Iranian consumers include its moisture resistance properties and the fact that it can replace a variety of wood products due to its durability and plasticity. However, its high price compared with compact wood panels has been monitored as a concern. The main vision of the founders of Decowood Company has been to raise public awareness about this industry and its special benefits in environmental issues and protection of wood resources in the country. Therefore, with the intent to spread this important issue at the national level, the founders of this company have concentrated their investment activities in this industry and pride themselves on having produced and delivered high-quality products with wide variety of decorative and utilitarian applications. Because wood plastic composite starts as a paste, it can be molded to almost any shape.